mentioned Ballarat, Australia, and I don't know if you're familiar, but there is a Ballarat, California, which is a ghost town. It made me wonder about the ghost towns. There's a lot of them around Death Valley. And how much of that was, I mean, especially Ballarat, you know, was it Cornish?
Well, it was Cornish, among other people, Ballarat. I like it better than being Cornish, but that's possibly interesting. It's very fine, because it's exactly the kind of thing that Cornish did there. The nomenclature with them, they're having a Ballarat here. At one level, surprises me, I haven't come across that before. Another level, it doesn't surprise me at all, because that's what the kind of thing that the Cornish did. And there were people from Ballarat who went across to Moonsbury in South Australia, like in the 1870s. They built a new row of cottages for themselves, and they called it Ballarat Row. Similar kind of thing. And people who went from Moota, that big copper mining district in South Australia, they go over to Western Australia for a gold rush down in the 1890s, and they set up a Moota camp. It was part of South Broken Hill in New South Wales, known for a time as Moota Town, and so on. So it's a trick, yeah, that's fascinating.
Do you have any information on the Cornish who went to Washington and Oregon to work with coal mines?
Not really. Other than the fact that to note that they kind of they did. I mean, a lot of people have an opportunity to sort of weave into the story today. So I'm aware of them working in Oregon. If my colleague Gary Fisher was here, he would be heard, but I didn't talk about the aircraft factories in Washington State. Yeah. He had people who went out there to work in the aircraft industry in the 1920s. So lots of dimensions for that.
If we have a dinner in Cornwall, we have a dinner right down the road.
Is that right?
Maybe in the back, maybe for the... Yes, ma'am.
In 1912, my grandmother's brother, whose family had been in Dubai City for three generations already, worked in Japan for 2 years. And I've always wondered why. He was a minor. Was there something going on in Japan in 1912 to 1914? Why he would have gone there to work?
Well, that's a very interesting question.
Specific ramp, I just don't
know. Yeah. I have to go away and look at that. I mean, what you can say is that period, there was a lot of British interest generally in Japan. Japan was seen as being a strategic British ally in the Pacific. In that part of the Britain was kind of lending technological and industrial support to a variety of things that the Japanese were doing, like the government, so on and so forth. But, well, been in the spirit of that. I do know that one of British Pacific's forebears went to Japan, and his great grandson or whatever is a man called Frank Okuno, who is a Japanese Cornishman who lives in, I think, Hampshire now. Comes back regularly to Cornwall on Trevilly Day, a particular day that celebrates British Trevilly Capital in April of every year. So there is a Japanese link out there lurking somewhere. We should do that. Yeah.
Yes, in the 1930s, William Bligh was portrayed as being a quite brutal person, and since then there have been others who say that was exaggerated. What is your view of William Bligh?
My view of what, sorry?
William Bligh.
Captain Bligh. What is my sort of personal view of Bligh's experience? I think you may be, well, it's kind of unlucky to be involved in two views in it. I mean, the kind of historic view is that this is a reflection on his style of leadership. On the one hand, he left the ship company after blacks. And then he cracked the whip too vigorously when it was time to go. Similarly, then when he was in New South Wales, instead of recognising that his predecessors had not been able to deal efficiently with the rum port, instead of finding new diplomatic means to kind of wheel his way in, he's going to confront them head on. And that's been the traditional view, but I sense that more recently there's been a kind of revisionism. In both those circumstances, he was actually victim of circumstances. He
Yes, ma'am. Lady of Stand.
I just wanted to know if Philip would like to say something about Jimmy Jeffries, the local preacher who went from California to Ballarat and then ended up in Fruita.
Who's that, sorry?
Jimmy Jeffries.
The musician fellow.
No, the local preacher.
Oh, yeah, the local preacher, the local, you know. Yeah, well, I guess to say that he is another sort of an example of that town. He was a local preacher who, he was a, in a sense, he gave a story not a lot of your head, but he is the guy, he was a local preacher, preached on the Victoria Beacon.
During the gold rush time, there was a very prominent kind of drawing out from the gold rush. There's also a pushing up effect in a lot of countries due to famine or lack of housing or poverty or rebellions and wars. What caused a lot of the Cornish to leave?
Did you catch that one? I'm afraid I couldn't hear the question.
No? Okay.
She's very angry.
During the gold rush,
yeah.
There was a major draw to California to get gold. But in many countries, there was also a pushing out effect, meaning that there was a lot of wars or famine or lack of housing.
Yeah.
What caused the Cornish to leave?
Oh, okay. That's an exceptionally good question. It's one that I just kind of hinted on here and there as I went through. But the answer is perhaps a surprisingly complex one. I will never be saying at the beginning that the real period of immigration is 1815 to 1914. During that period, a lot happens in Cornwall. In that early period, as I'm suggesting, the international mining frontier is developing apace. Latin America, United States, Australia, and so on and so forth. Cornwall is still at the pinnacle in reputation, wise, if you like, at the center of world mining expertise. And so the Cornish are kind of drawn across to the new destination. They're enticed by promises of high wages and so on and so forth. But while that's happening, there are undercurrents of change in Cornwall. The 1830s are a time of political discontent in Britain as a whole, and in Cornwall in particular. Cornwall emerges as a focus of what you might call liberal, Methodist, non-conformist radicalism. In other words, people who weren't tied to the Anglican Church, who saw themselves as free worshippers, but who began to look overseas for new opportunities for religious freedom, economic advancement, civic liberty, social mobility, all that kind of stuff. And places like America, and indeed South Australia, appealed very much to people with those kind of political motivations. And then in the 1840s, we all know about the Irish potato famine. What we sometimes forget is that there was a potato famine in Cornwall as well, because the rapid development of the Cornish population, particularly in the mining areas in the early part of the 19th century, had made significant bits of the population dependent on potato, just as the Irish one was. And the Cornish crop failed in 1845 and in 1846, just as it did in Ireland. But what kind of saved Cornwall, if you like, from starvation were those conduits, those channels of emigration that had already been set up. And the 1840s, the hungry 40s in Cornwall, are also the time of the developing of the mines of Burrabung and Pumba in South Australia and over at Michigan as well. So they have the safety valve. And then, without going on too much, in 1866, the bottom falls out of the world copper market. The new world mines, which are rich and shallow and so on, can ride all that. Cornwall can't, because mines are old and deep and so on. There's a big credit crunch in 1866, and one of the big British banks involved in mining investment crashes. And as I say to my students, Cornwall never recovered from the credit crunch of 1866, which is kind of true. And then in the 1870s, the problems in the tin industry as well. And suddenly, lots of Cornish copper and tin mines are closing down. And again, widespread unemployment is averted in Cornwall, because it's those conduits that still exist to places the world over. And at the end of the 19th century, I was suggesting South Africa emerged as a great new destination. That's the new safety valve for potentially unemployed miners.
story of the Tommy Knocker?
The real story of the Tommy Knocker is I've got an expert here from Robert Jenkins.
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah, what's the real story of the Tommy Knockers? Or the Knockers, or the Knackers, as they call them, which are supposed to be the little people who live deep underground and who, one way or another, will confront the miner. The various Cornish law, they are, or sometimes they're supposed to be the lost souls of Jews, you know, Jewish spirits and so on, forever wandering the labyrinths of the Cornish mines and some kind of purgatory, fixing my religion, so never mind. But that kind of, there's a famous story about collected by one of the folklore collectors towards the end of the 19th century, about a miner called Tommy Trevorrow, who ignored the appeals of the Tommy Knockers. He heard the Tommy Knockers calling, he said, leave us a bit of your ground for free, for your pasty, whatever it is. And the other miners all dutifully did that, they left that. Tommy Trevorrow is headstrong and he refuses to give in to the Tommy Knockers. He doesn't leave a little tribute for them. And something terrible befalls him. I can't remember what it is. I have to go back to the collection of the 19th century. But I think what it is a sense of these people that there is, like a lot of people, a sense of superstition. They're working very deep underground, dark, dangerous, fearsome kind of environment. It would be odd. They didn't develop those kinds of superstitions and various sort of taboos and ways of behaving and so on and so forth.
One last question. Yes, ma'am.
I have another question. You mentioned earlier about the newspapers in Cornwall making it sound like actually wonderful places to come to California and all that. Did anybody in Cornwall do anything to try to discourage the brain drain?
That's a very good, another very good question. There was very little discouragement for these sorts of brain drain. Towards the end of the 19th century, people began to wake up to, I think, what the vicar suggested, they were losing the bones and sinew of the country, and only the dross were remaining behind.
All of you who are not going to